I'm speaking with Annie Mahadeo, who's the Pesticide Education Coordinator for the Parks Department through the City of Guelph. And I'm wondering, Anita, if just to start off, with respect to private property in Guelph, can you remind our listeners about what current council direction is regarding pesticide usage?
Well, there isn't any sort of regulation currently about pesticide use on private property. Council, in a resolution last May, does endorse and promote the use of pesticide-free methods of lawn and garden care, though.
And so that, hence, the position that you have come into now with the city.
Mm-hmm.
What programs are currently in place that you're working on developing around pesticide education?
Well, currently the Parks Department has some education projects set up. They run ads and information about alternative to pesticide care on your lawn in the Tribune and the Guelph Leisure Guide during the seasons. They do radio ads at times, but they've been limited in what they've had done education so far. So that's essentially why I was hired, is to research what other municipalities are doing in terms of education and to pick and choose or what are deemed as the best practices, what have shown to be most effective to apply those to Guelph.
Mm-hmm. What have been some of the other models in other cities that have intrigued you so far?
Oh, there have been some really excellent models. I mean, one that I've mentioned to other people just because it's quite unique. I don't know if it would work in Guelph, but Oakville, through a organization called the Countryside Alliance, has a program called the Ouija Kids. And what they do there is they have university students with a horticultural background in charge of high school students, and they go around on their bicycles into the community, and they distribute information on alternative to pesticides and for your lawn and your garden. And they take these to home and they explain it to people. And if anybody wants to have assistance or someone to come and show them some of the practices they can do, then those groups go to their home. So that's a really, really creative one, yeah, that's come across. There's also been a lot of creative community-type events. Some communities, as you probably know, like Kitchener, has the Dandelion Festival, which really works on showing some of the benefits of something like the dandelion, which some people think are great because it makes good wine and has medicinal properties, and other people just think it's the most awful thing in the world.
Right. Now currently there's some focus group meetings that are underway in collaboration with Professor Jim Mahone of the Rural Extension Studies School here at the University of Guelph to receive feedback from community members based on ward. And I'm just wondering if you can explain a little bit about the purpose of these focus groups and what your expected outcomes are from this.
Okay, Jennifer. Yeah, the purpose of the focus groups, that also comes out of the council resolution of May 26th of last year. Council stated they supported the promotion and endorsement of pesticide-free methods of lawn and garden care. So that's what we were going with and looking at education programs. But we found that every community varies in how their residents take care of their lawns and what their views are towards pesticide use. And I found that more and more municipalities are doing things like holding focus groups and having phone or paper surveys to find out what people's perspectives really are. So that's why we are having the focus groups in Guelph, is to gauge residents' actual practices in terms of pesticide use or alternative use in their own lawn care. And that'll help us when we're finalizing what resources we can put towards education programs to see what it is out there is being demanded. Are people asking questions about what sort of alternative ground covers are out there? Or they really want to know what the health effects of pesticides are before they choose to use pesticide-free methods of lawn care. So that's the main purpose of our focus groups.
And I know that you're sort of midway in that process right now, but do you have a sense or could you maybe describe what you feel might characterize some of the practices that are currently being used in Guelph?
Well, I think it varies, and we've had two. So we've got three more to go through. So it's hard to say exactly. I think it really quite varies. So far, it seems that we have the extremes where people will absolutely not use any sort of pesticides at all on their property because they believe it has certain health effects, whereas some people will use it if necessary. But certainly we haven't come across anyone who will just abuse it. So that's been encouraging to hear that people are open to the possibility of using alternatives if they just receive a little bit more information about it.
Sure. And as well, there's a stakeholder committee that has also been struck in order to make additional recommendations regarding this process and implementation of pesticide reduction within Guelph. Who sits on this committee, and what is their sort of mandate around these meetings?
The committee was formed out of a request from that same council resolution of May 26, 2003. And it requested that staff establish a stakeholder committee with representation from the University of Guelph, from public health in Guelph, the lawn care industry, environmental organizations, and citizen representation. So we formed such a committee, and their primary mandate is to advise the Parks Department on a Healthy Landscapes program. And this program includes all the education materials that we've been talking about, but it also includes giving us feedback on practices in lawn care, accreditation requirements, things that deal with buffer zones, including the role of the health unit, which hadn't been included in the past, and possibly creating another pesticide advisory committee to oversee the implementation of all these programs once they've been finalized.
Right. And have there been any particular challenges that have arisen so far or that are becoming more evident as you go through this process with the committee?
Other than it's taking a little more time than we anticipated, but the committee works well together. I mean, obviously, we have sought varied opinions so that we can have expertise from the different areas and we can have the different opinions from our community. So there is often an opportunity for debate, but so far we haven't found that has impeded working through our agenda, which I think is great. So far there hasn't been a huge impediment other than we're hoping that we can get through with some resources as the main question in terms of implementing a lot of the programs that we're deciding on and that we're finalizing. The question of what resources we're going to get in the end to implement that is probably the biggest question mark.
And in that regard, I did sort of take a little bit of look at the minutes from the April 28th meeting and noted that there will be some differences in terms of how education is carried out within sort of the individual toward the individual citizen versus toward the retail sector, which is also an important piece of how this is carried through. Are there particular sort of challenges, or maybe can you describe some of the differences in terms of working with the retail sector over the individual sort of homeowner?
We decided to do this year. We ran a pilot project called Healthy Lawn Training for the retail sector staff, and this was based on a similar pilot project that ran in Woodstock. And what we did was we got someone from the Guelph Turfgrass Institute to come in and give a presentation to some retailers in Guelph and their staff that we invited. And the main purpose of this was sort of a concern that homeowners, when they do use pesticides, may not be using it appropriately. They may be using too much of it, or they may be using it when they don't even need it. Or what often happens is they're using it at the wrong time of the year. So we really wanted to make sure that the people selling the product or the people being asked for advice were aware of what sort of advice to give to homeowners, and not just advice on when or how they should use their pesticide, but also advice on how they should take care of their lawn and garden to somehow prevent some of the problems they may have, which drives them to use pesticides. So really trying to focus on basics of lawn and garden care, things you can do besides pesticides to deal with weed or insect infestations. So that was the first time we ran that, and it went over very well. We got really good feedback. We're going to be doing a follow-up questionnaire with the retail staff that attended to see how that information may have helped them over this season. And we hope to be able to do it again next year.
Great. And how was the level of participation across the retail sector?
It was sort of moderate. We got excellent feedback when I approached the retailers. And certainly didn't get turned down to come to this. When it came to the actual presentation, I think we invited 9 or 10 retailers, and we got about 5 and their staff. So we got half, which still wasn't too bad. We did get calls afterwards, you know, explanations about staffing issues and lack of availability to attend, and there was an expression of interest in having that sort of presentation done in-house in the retail stores to deal with staffing issue, and also people really wanted to receive the information that was presented. So overall, I still think it was received well.
Mm-hmm. One of the big challenges, and this was already somewhat expressed by other Parks Department staff in terms of some of the challenges around implementing some of the goals that we have as a city around pesticide reduction or elimination, and in particular this has been raised around its application to sports fields and within municipal lands, and some of the challenges with not having enough money to carry out the process as it's been determined. What evidence do we have from other communities that have been following similar programs in terms of you know, education versus a bylaw approach to pesticide reduction or elimination, in terms of the cost to the city? Is there any evidence to suggest that following a more public education approach versus a bylaw enforcement approach is more efficient when it comes down to finances?
In terms of finances, no, there isn't evidence that a public education approach is cheaper, but it's really hard to gauge. The communities that have bylaws have really all just begun in terms of their enforcement stage, and I think that's the main aspect in terms of expenses, is the concern about the expenses related to the bylaw enforcement aspect of it. A lot of communities, before they even look at a bylaw, will start with an education program because it is more cost efficient. You can sort of limit and pick and choose what your education program is. In terms of the sports field, that is a complicated issue, and in more and more communities, on municipal property at least, there really is an emphasis on reducing pesticide use. The sports fields tend to be one of the main exceptions in that area, I think, because it is really difficult. The municipalities are finding that it is difficult to maintain a certain quality of the sports fields without pesticide use. On the other hand, a lot of them are feeling if they had more resources, that is something that can be done in terms of having the staff to sort of replace the pesticide use to deal with creating a good sports field. So I know that's the situation the Parks Department is at right now, trying to deal with the sports fields. They haven't, they didn't spray any on very limited public property last year, and nothing on sports fields at all. And they're trying to deal with that balance of residents' concerns about the quality of sports fields, yet the also residents' concerns about the use of pesticides.
And I'm just wondering, do you have any concerns, or how much will finances be a determining factor in the nature of the public education programs you're able to carry out?
It'll be a huge factor, I think. We have some excellent ideas, and as you mentioned, everything is posted on the draft programs, and the draft education projects are posted on the city website. We have some great ideas. We've sought out really good participation from community partners, all sorts of NGOs and the university and the Guelph Turfgrass Institute. But it comes down to what resources will we get in the end to have these education programs come out. We don't have very many resources to pursue much this year, so the question will be in, as part of next year's budget.
So this year will be mostly dedicated to just researching and coming up with what practices will be happening in the future.
Yeah, well, we've done the Healthy Lawn training, and we still have information in the Guelph Leisure Guide, and we'll still do inserts in the Tribune, and they'll probably do something in the fall, as they always do in terms of fall lawn care and putting your garden to bed. But there won't be any significant programs coming out of this year. I don't foresee that, at least.
Right. And I guess I'm just wondering, too, to sort of wrap up, how do you feel right now about Guelph's readiness as a community to move in a direction of pesticide reduction and elimination, just given that this has been a heated debate, not just in Guelph, but in other communities where these sorts of things have been arising quite concurrently, actually?
Yeah. Well, that's a difficult question. I think I'll probably have a better feel for that once the focus groups are over.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also putting in a request to have a phone survey done to look at the pesticide issue. So after that, we'll have a better view. Right now, as you can imagine, we get both sides of the argument all the time. But what we don't often get is the silent mass, who probably have an opinion and probably have certain practices they do in their own lawn and garden area, but don't express that. So it's sort of hard to judge, other than it is an important issue in Guelph. And we hope that we'll get a better feel of that once the focus groups are over, and if we get the resources to do a phone survey.
Which sounds like an excellent idea.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for your time this morning, and good luck with all your work.
Thank you very much, and if anyone has any questions about the focus groups or any questions about what's going on in the process, they can look on the city website, or they can phone me at 837-2937 or email me at pesticideproject@hotmail.com.
Super.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you very much. What is your general reaction to the budget as it was announced on Tuesday?
Well, we're actually really disappointed with the budget on a number of levels. One is that I don't think we ever anticipated that they would come up with such a regressive tax regime as coming up with the health user fees, basically the OHIP user fees, or health care premiums, as they're calling them. And I don't even know if the Tories would have come up with such a regressive tax scheme. Now, we're happy that they realized that you can't hope to have the level of social services and infrastructure that people in Ontario want without coming up with some way of generating revenue. And that's what we've been arguing all along, is that the promise that they made to the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, which is that they were not going to raise taxes, was ludicrous, given that the last 10 years we've seen taxes cut and cut further. We've seen the creation of over 100 tax loopholes, which by and large benefit high-income earners and corporations. We've seen corporate tax cuts. So there just isn't the revenue there to sustain the kind of services that people in Ontario want. So we knew that they were going to have to break that promise in order to deliver even a fraction of the promises that they made. But what we had hoped is that they would use the personal income tax system in such a way that the tax increase would be fair and equitable. And what they did by introducing the healthcare premiums is they made it so that there's very little difference between the amount of money that a low-income family is going to pay and the amount of money that a high-income family is going to pay. So that's one sort of side to it. And then in terms of the amount of money that they're actually putting back into healthcare, into education, into what we're particularly concerned about, which is social services, it's really, it's a pittance. It's small change compared to what needs to go in to make up for a decade of neglect and cuts. And so I find it a bit funny that this government seems so triumphant and jubilant about the budget that they brought down yesterday.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about some of the things that they did say that they were providing under their heading of stronger communities? They, just quoting from his speech, he says that he was making the long overdue announcement, was how he framed it, around increasing by 3% the basic allowance and maximum shelter allowance for ODSP, Ontario Disability Support Program, and Ontario Works recipients. Certainly, we have long awaited some increases to those rates. But can you maybe frame that within the context of what people that are on social assistance are experiencing right now?
Sure. And you know, I want to say first off that you know it's definitely a change in that the Liberals aren't doing the kind of poor bashing that the Tories did. Mm. And for that, we're really happy. And, you know, a raise is it's a step in the right direction. But what we're afraid of is that they're just going to ignore the fact that social assistance rates were cut 21% in 1995 and were frozen from that point on, and that ODSP was frozen since 1993, so that people on social assistance are living, we're not just a little bit below the poverty line, we're talking thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars below the poverty line. It's dire. People are having to make really difficult decisions like, do I feed myself and my kids, or do I risk getting evicted because I can't afford to pay rent? And these are the kinds of tough decisions that families on social assistance and individuals on social assistance are facing every single day. So that's the context. Within that context, 3% is very little money for a single adult on Ontario Disability Support Program. It works out to $27 and some change a month, which when you're living $5,000 below the poverty line, it's hardly any money. You know, if you have a child, it lets you buy another bag of diapers. People are still going to be visiting food banks. People are still going to be making tough decisions. And so what we're afraid of is that the Liberals will see this 3% raise as, their good deed towards, as they put it in their document, the most vulnerable people in Ontario, and leave it at that and not account for the fact that, we're basically needing a 35 to 40% increase to get people just to the poverty line. Mm. Nowhere in this document or nowhere in the budget was there indication that they were going to do that. I was under no illusion that they were going to increase the rates by that much in 1 year. But I thought that there might be some indication to a medium or long-term strategy, and that's not in the budget. The Liberals campaigned on a promise to get rid of the National Child Benefits Supplement clawback, which is essentially a program designed by the federal government to direct money to help children in the most high risk and low income families in Canada, and for a family of two, for example, that would work out to about $2,500 a year. So that money is basically given by the federal government and then taken, in one hand, and then taken in the other hand by the provincial government back. And if that money was, to stay with the low income families and the families on social assistance who need it, then that would go a long way in terms of helping them be able to survive and make ends meet. It wouldn't solve all the problems, but it would be a good signal to us that the province is serious about tackling issues like child poverty. What they did do, rather than get rid of the clawback, is they said, well, we're not going to claw back the increase that the federal government's going to give between 2003 and 2004. So we're looking at, a whole big, like, $80 a year. Is nothing compared to the thousands of dollars that are taken away from low-income families by the provincial government. So I don't see anywhere in the budget a sense that the Ministry of Community and Social Services and Minister Pupatello is really, really serious about tackling poverty. and they gave themselves a standing ovation. So, you know, clearly they're proud of this 3% increase, and they think it's sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it just signals that anti-poverty activists across the province have a lot of work cut out for us, and we're going to have to continue to put a lot of pressure on this government to tell them it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to hear a little bit about what some of those plans might be in terms of upcoming campaigns that you have. But one other thing that I was thinking as I was reading through this, the fact that they presented this as not merely, you know, this year's budget, but really kind of a plan for the next 4 years, mm-hmm. was there, or did you feel, I know that you spent some time lobbying your MPs in the Toronto area and really, you know, trying to put some emphasis on these issues with politicians. Did you feel a little bit that by saying that they weren't just trying to say, okay, you know, we're looking at this responsibly for the long term, but also that it was kind of like, okay, we've made our decisions for the next 4 years. This is our plan. This is how we're carrying it out. Thanks for the discussion, everybody.
Well, I kind of think that the door's been left open a little bit.
Okay.
I don't think that it's a foregone conclusion that there won't be any raises to social assistance. They did say that they're going to review the program, they're going to review the clawback. I don't know what they have to review.
mm-hmm.
Personally, I think it's pretty clear that people need the money and they need the rates to be raised, and we need to figure out how to do that as quickly as possible. But by saying that they're going to undergo a review, that says to me that the door is at least open. It hasn't been fully shut. Within the budget, they do say that they're going to try to limit program spending to 1.9% a year as an increase. So that causes some concern. That's a bit disconcerting because 1.9% next year is, like I said, you're going to barely even keep up with inflation between this year and next year.
Mm-hmm.
So it really would signal to us that there isn't going to be any significant change or help to low-income families. But I want to remind people that in the late 80s, there was a massive campaign called 25% Just for Food and Rent, and that anti-poverty activists organized all over Ontario. There was a massive march on Queen's Park. There were 5,000 people, which is one of the largest anti-poverty demonstrations that the province has ever seen, and that it did result in a substantial hike to social assistance rates with the Liberal government. So if we do our work and continue to build a movement, I think that we just might be able to convince them that this is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the plans with respect to upcoming campaigns that the Ontario Coalition for Social Justice will be involved with?
Well, last year we launched our Ontario Needs a Raise campaign, and we actually, you know, I don't want to paint the situation as too dire. I actually think that our campaign, along with other campaigns like Pay the Rent, Feed the Kids, which was largely spearheaded through the Daily Bread Food Bank and some of the other food banks in Ottawa, I think that those campaigns had an impact, and they made poverty issues on the radar. They made them on the radar screen during the election, and that a lot of the lobbying work that went on in the last few months helped to make sure that the Liberals didn't back down on their promises to raise social assistance rates. So I think that we can claim a victory in terms of making it an issue. And they, you know, they didn't follow through on their promise around the clawback, but they raised the rates actually a little bit more than they said they were going to. So, you know, like, that's a victory for us. But we have to continue the campaign. So we're calling it Ontario Still Needs a Raise. And we're actually having a meeting next week with representatives across the province. We'll be planning a province-wide tour, coordinated provincial actions on October 2nd, which is the one-year anniversary of the Liberals being elected. And we're talking about replicating the march that happened in the late 80s, which helped to put pressure on raising the rate substantially. So there's a lot in the works, and we're trying to work with as many communities and organizations as possible to really get people thinking about the poverty crisis in Ontario.
Excellent. And I guess just a couple of other points that I'm just wondering if you've been sort of looking at with respect to the budget documents. Did you see anything here that had any substance around affordable housing?
Well, Michael Shapcott, who sits with us on the Ontario Alternative Budget and is considered one of Canada's foremost housing experts, sent a press release out yesterday saying that this budget is basically a slap in the face to housing activists and comes nowhere near meeting the promise that the Liberals made around affordable housing, which was seen by many housing activists as inadequate at any rate. So although there are definitely some increases to public housing, which is a step forward from where the Tories were at, it doesn't come anywhere near addressing the fact that we've had almost a 10-year freeze on affordable housing. And we have to realize it all has to be part of a package. Affordable housing is obviously connected to income security, to affordable child care, to affordable health care. And all of these issues relate together. And if we don't have proper housing and waiting lists that are shorter than 9 years to get subsidized housing in Toronto, then we're just going to see the homelessness crisis balloon in this province. And so I think we have a lot of work to do on all those fronts in making sure that we link the different issues under the larger banner of poverty and income security.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps where Minister Sobera talks about wanting to put some new emphasis on things like preventative health care and such, drawing in those ties that having a living wage and sufficient housing and such is also a health care issue.
Yeah, then those are totally related to health care. And I mean, as an aside, I don't think that they're really that committed to preventative health care when they delist things like chiropractic and physiotherapy from what's covered under OHIP, because those are preventative measures around health care. When they charge the surcharge or the health care premiums. So I think that, again, we're looking at very short-sighted planning in this budget and a lack of thinking about the long term, in my opinion, because they were afraid to make corporations pay their fair share and to come up with a progressive income tax increase that would ensure that all Ontario residents pay a fair share of what they make, rather than once again following in the Tory pattern, basically helping out the rich funds of the government in power and making sure that high-income earners get away with paying very, very little.
And just a final note on that, you mention again the need for the revenue generation through the income tax sort of structure. And this was something I heard you say when you visited Guelph a month or so ago, and you talked about being involved in a participatory budget process and sitting around a table with people from a wide variety of political perspectives and angles, and hearing there that there was an openness to that approach to revenue generation. And what I heard today in some of the media reaction to me was sort of entrenching the concepts around the need for tax relief and the government is stealing again out of our, lifting our wallets out of our back pocket, I think was a comment I heard this morning, and just how that doesn't seem to jive with the kind of thing that that you were communicating there in terms of what you were hearing at that sort of round table.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's people are not stupid. They recognize that if we're going to have really good services, that there has to be some way of paying for them. And I think that people are willing to pay for them if it's a fair and equitable way of paying for it. But, I mean, just to give you just a short, quick example, in the Ontario Alternative Budget, we recommended that there be a 5% increase to each tax rate, and that we have a new tax bracket of 2% at $100,000, which would parallel the federal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And what that would mean is an income of $35,000 would have seen an increase in $80 in terms of the amount of taxes that they pay to their personal income tax. Instead, under the health care premium, an income of $35,000 will now pay $300 under this premium. Now, under the 5% increase that the Ontario Alternative Budget recommended, an income of $100,000 would have paid $643 more in income tax, and under this budget, they'll pay $750 with the healthcare premium. Now, where this really sort of comes to play is if you make $2 million, for example, all you have to pay is $900. If you make $275,000, all you have to pay is $900. So that $900 cap on the amount of people that they on the amount that people have to pay on the premium means that really high income earners are not paying their fair share. So that a low income person's paying well over 1% of their income in this health care surtax. But if you're making $500,000, it's 0.18% of your income. So it really hits the low and middle income earners a lot harder than the high income earners. And with the progressive income tax system, you can make sure that that those who can afford to can pay more.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
And so that's why I think the some people are reacting to this as stealing from people's pockets, because it really is, in some ways, a hidden tax.
The organizing meeting that you said is happening next week, is that a public meeting that's taking place?
It's geared at people who and organizations who want to participate in helping to develop the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So if they would like to get involved, they can contact the OCSJ. And our email address is ocsj@ocsj.ca. And if folks want to plug in to the campaign, they can check our website, which is www.ocsj.ca, and it will be updated in the next few days with all of the new information coming out of the budget.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much for doing this for me at the end of your day.
Thank you.
And have a good evening.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.